From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar, and this week we have journalist and activist Tony Solo reporting on news and events in Latin America and the Caribbean from Managua, Nicaragua. Tony, welcome.
Hi, Don. Thanks for having me back on your program. It's always good to talk to you.
Same. So we got a lot. Let's jump in wherever you like.
Well, and it's a, I think the overall tone of the week has been one of that's quite depressing for people who believe in all and support all the work that the progressive governments in South America, Central America, and the Caribbean have achieved over the last 10, 15 years or so. Because it seems pretty clear that the situation in Venezuela, for example, is pretty intractable for reasons that we might talk about later. And the situation in Brazil doesn't look great for the Workers' Party leaders, Dilma Rousseff, who's still the president for the moment, despite being suspended by the impeachment process that was set in train by the Brazilian legislature. And in Argentina, it looks as though Mauricio Macri is going to tough it out against the growing opposition to his policies there.
Yeah, plus he's adding a U.S. military base, and perhaps two.
Yeah, so people who like us who support those progressive governments in Latin America and the Caribbean, we're probably in for quite a depressing period of 12, 18 months, maybe longer, because you've probably been following the events in Brazil more closely than I have, because I've been trying to focus on what's happening in Venezuela a bit more.
Yeah,
but from what I can gather, what's going on in Brazil is that Carlos Temer, the interim president, has gone far beyond his remit as an interim president.
Right.
And he's actually put in place the legislative agenda, the administrative agenda of Aécio Neves, who lost the election to Dilma Rousseff back in 2014. And essentially what Temer has done is betrayed Dilma Rousseff and switched sides, because he was elected as Dilma Rousseff's vice president to implement Dilma Rousseff's program as the PT. And he and his colleagues have actually, especially over the last year, worked deliberately to stymie and prevent Dilma Rousseff from implementing that program. And now he's come right out and done he's revealed his true colors, if to put it in that phrase. And he's now working very closely with the right-wing opposition that lost the election in 2014, which
That's
is,
right.
and you can see how that right, and he's named corrupt individuals to ministries. He's talking about changing the government's financial and economic policy to make it a hardline austerity program, similar to that implemented by Macri in Argentina. And that wasn't what he was voted in for.
That's right.
You know, that's not, you know, so
he wasn't voted in either. You know, a vice president isn't supposed to step in, fire all the ministers and hire a new cabinet and reorient domestic policy and international relations, by the way, which is exactly what this one is doing with 2% popular support, according to the polls.
Yeah, my argument about what's been happening at the moment in Latin America is that it's got nothing to do with some kind of natural change of opinion in the region whereby the people at grassroots decide, now it's time to move with the ideological swing of the pendulum and let's all be right-wing now.
Right. Right.
It's got nothing to do with that.
No, it's clearly an offensive. This is a right-wing offensive that's acting in coordination with the domestic elites, the domestic economic elites, and the media, and the United States government and CIA, et cetera. It's obvious now.
Yeah, and I've referred to it over the last couple of months in our discussions as essentially an usurpation of power, an illegitimate usurpation of power. Although, you know, and they followed the rules, you know, but the rules were already put in place by the enemy many years ago.
Well, you could say yes, in some fashion they have. For example, they followed the rules in Argentina with the election of a president. But in the case of Dilma Rousseff, there is no constitutional authority for them to run this procedure without charging her with a criminal offense. And they have yet to mention a criminal offense.
Yeah, and so in theory, it should be, on that basis, it should be perfectly easy, in theory, for Lula and Dilma and their supporters to convince sufficient legislators in the Senate to vote against the final vote on whether or not Dilma Rousseff should be impeached. But is that going to happen? Well, who knows? I know so much depends both on the internal situation in Brazil. What Lula and Dilma seem to be betting on is that if they can mobilize enough support out in the streets and mobilize enough public opinion, they'll be able to, that they're hoping will cause sufficient number of senators in the Brazilian Senate to change their minds and to vote against the process impeaching Dilma. Will they be able to do that? We just don't know. And at the moment, there's very, in São Paulo, for example, there's a very serious teacher strike, and hundreds of schools have been occupied by school students, and that is directly related to their rejection of Temer, who, as you say, has virtually zero support in the country, and is a complete usurper in terms of the presidency. So
you even had some pushback by the generals in Brazil against Temer. Temer's first nominee, I think, for defense minister, was rejected by them.
Right, and the army in Brazil, and it's historically the army has been a repressive force in Brazil, right?
Yep.
So and as an internal level, and they in the past have been strongly associated with the coup that ousted President Goulart in 1964. But over recently, and they've been, you know, they've been essentially a normal kind of army. They haven't been intervening in any way in the civilian affairs of Brazil, and that's you can see that from, what is it, 15 years now of government by the Workers' Party. Lula da Silva and Dilma Rousseff and the army have played a very legitimate role within those progressive governments that have been in Brazil for the last, what is it, 12, 13 years, something like that. But that's their internal profile. Right. But externally, their profile is anti-United States. Because if you read documentation in relation to, well, what is Brazil's military policy? What is their stance within the region? The Brazilian army views the main threat to Brazil's sovereignty to be the United States designs on the Amazon.
Right.
And so, you know, and it doesn't surprise me at all that in that sense, the Brazilian army will probably push back against the pro-US foreign policy that is likely to be promoted by Temer and his cronies.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it's really interesting there. And you know, that's a question that we've been asking, looking around the region as... you know, it appears that the elites with U.S. backing and or direction or coordination or involvement in one kind or another are making this, you know, conducting this offensive, basically, that's really never stopped, but has really come full blown over the past year or so. We've been saying, you know, part of the decision as they head towards constitutional crises in these various countries with the division between the president and the legislature. Now we've seen in Venezuela, Argentina, and Brazil that the role of the army is going to be important. And we've been talking about that in Venezuela, but it's true also in both Argentina and Brazil, with the legacy, of course, of the role that the army's played in all of those countries.
Yeah, in Argentina, I don't have a good feel for the current profile of the army in Argentina. And I suspect that the great majority of the medium and senior officials in the Argentinian army would rather just let the civilians sort things out, because for obvious reasons, they don't want to get involved directly in politics. And so, because it would just be you know, really bad news for them. In Argentina, and what's going on? Macri, he got into office on false electoral promises, and now he's implementing a program that he did not put to the voters during his election campaign. And he did not say to the voters, "Well, I'm going to sack hundreds of thousands of public sector workers in my first week in office." He didn't, obviously, he didn't say that, but that's what he's doing, and he's engaging he's now indebted Argentina to the tune of $16 billion, which is likely to turn into much more than that over time, as a result of the Vulture Fund dispute. And as you say, his policy, his foreign policy now has gone 180 degrees in terms of its stance in comparison with the foreign policy of Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. And he's now given the go ahead for this US military base in Argentina, which for the great majority of people in Argentina is something that they reject, because that they associate that with the dictatorship. And you can see that in the declarations by the Madres of the Plaza de Mayo, the mothers of so many of the 30,000 people that were disappeared by the Argentinian dictatorship, with which the family of Mauricio Macri, incidentally, was very closely associated. So the sequel to all that is that the Argentinian legislature has passed some legislation very much at the instigation of popular criticism of Macri's economic policy, and they've passed some legislation to try and bring some kind of stability to the people in employment in Argentina. And the original proposal was to pass a law making it almost impossible for employers without good cause without very, very clear financial economic reasons for firing somebody to dismiss anybody from their job. But in the legislature, the kind of center parties, in particular the party led by this guy Massa, who came third in the first round of the presidential elections last year, and subsequently his supporters made it possible for Macri just to win, but I think Macri won by something like 2%. And it's Massa's party in the parliament that is now trying to hedge its bets still, by kind of reducing that period of a year, vetoing the dismissal of people from their employment to 6 months. But they did pass the legislation, but even in its watered-down form, Macri has vetoed it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we have a situation, very, like, as you pointed out in two or three previous programs, you have a situation in Venezuela that's kind of the mirror image of the situation. Sorry, we have a situation in Argentina, sorry, that's the mirror image of the situation in Venezuela, where a reactionary, in almost fascist controlled national legislature finds the measures that it tries to pass vetoed by a progressive president. And in Argentina, it's the opposite of that. You've got a legislature that's trying to defend the basic rights, basic economic rights in particular, of the Argentinian people, passing legislation that's then vetoed by a right-wing president. So, and that's in Argentina, the situation isn't as volatile yet as the situation in Venezuela, but you have the same mix of things. Sharp price rises,
right.
Grassroots facing very serious economic difficulties as a result of what they perceive as government policy, right or wrong, in both countries, and that you're likely to see a similar situation in Brazil developing with because Temer is going full belt for the implementation of an extreme neoliberal economic agenda. So, and the situation in Brazil and Argentina is very young compared to the situation in Venezuela, where that situation has been developing over the last, ever since the death of Hugo Chavez, really. You know, so and that's the situation in Venezuela is a couple of years ahead of how things are going to turn out in Brazil and Argentina. And the difference in Venezuela is that you have a government that respects human rights and isn't going to engage in wholesale repression, whereas in Brazil you have governments who have no respect for people's basic rights, and they are going to implement wholesale repression against the wave of popular opposition that is certain to surge out of the developing economic crises that those two countries are going to impose on ordinary working people.
Mm, yeah.
That's how I see things in general. And as you say, Don, the Brazil, Argentina and Venezuela, these are the really three key countries that if the United States and its allies can manage to impose, even in the short term, over the next 2-3 years and until the next election, because the next election in Argentina will be in, 2019. Right. The next election in Brazil is 2018. Right. And in Venezuela, there may even be an election this year, depending on the outcome of the recall process that's underway.
Right. You know, there's an interesting response from, you had an exchange of words between the head of the right wing and, from Capriles and Maduro. And it was, Capriles threatening, basically he almost literally called on the army to oust Maduro.
Yeah.
And Maduro said that he didn't expect that the legislature would be sitting much longer. To me, that sounds like a showdown that may, take place in territory outside of the Constitution on either side. And again, the role of the military may end up being an important one, and of the people, of course, of the people.
Yeah, and the situation in Venezuela, it is of such great, it's absolutely crucial, isn't it? It's of such great concern to anybody that cares about kind of the general progress of the region, the well-being of the great majority of people in the region, because if the right-wing opposition take power in Venezuela, they are going to engage in massive repression against the Chavistas, against the Partido Socialista, the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, and that it'll be it'll be a massive setback achieved again by usurpation, by illegitimate means, because Nicolas Maduro and Chavez, throughout their periods in government, have persistently called on the political opposition in Venezuela to dialogue, to engage in some kind of attempt to build consensus. And it's the right wing that have always rejected that, because ultimately they rely on external forces for their support. And at the moment, there it may be the case. It may even be the case that they could win a presidential election if the recall vote goes ahead and results in that process. But
right.
That's not because they naturally have that support. It's a very in Venezuela, it reminds me so much of the situation in 1990 in Nicaragua.
Yeah.
Because people were absolutely exhausted. They're sick of conflict. They're sick of all the difficulties provoked by the various economic problems. And that is not the government's fault. You know, and to some extent, you can say, all right, the Venezuelan government has engaged in misguided economic policies, and these have created a situation that has led to the current kind of shortages in the availability of basic goods. It's not so much the material unavailability. I mean, the goods are in the Venezuelan economy, but the distortions in the economy make it more rational in a neoliberal sense for people to sell those goods either on the black market or export them to Colombia or even Brazil or Guyana, even, where they can get a better price. And so that's causing the shortages. Now, you can argue the toss about, you know, what are the economic policies that have brought that about?
Well, the primary one, really, I mean, if you look at it closely, the primary problem with distribution has been hoarding and manipulation by the elites, by the corporate elites, and that was clearly a political move that was intended to undercut support for the government. The government's mistake, if there is a mistake, and if it was available to them as a remedy, was their failure to basically seize the privately owned aspects of the distribution network and of whatever other inputs there are into the economic delivery system, and can take control of it themselves, which of course would have provoked most likely either a U.S. invasion or military intervention or some other. I mean, it's not like they have a free hand to you know, go directly to socialism just because the elites misbehave locally. So,
yeah,
you know, there's that problem.
Yeah, and that takes us back to what I was saying, that the Venezuelan opposition depend on external forces to be able to carry out their very carefully prepared and designed destabilization program. And it's a very similar destabilization program to what was facing Nicaragua back in the 1980s. And so the question now is, oil prices have recovered a little bit to just under $50. And if that can be sustained for a period of 2 or 3 months, and if the Venezuelan government can mobilize sufficient external support, for example, as you pointed out to me just now, before we started discussion, and China has agreed another tranche of, I think it's 20, was it 20 billion?
20 billion, yeah.
$20 billion that will enable, that will free up resources. That money is devoted to infrastructure, housing, and similar
right.
projects,
right.
which is a typical Chinese development aid package.
Right.
From the Chinese government has engaged in other countries as well.
Right, but it's an input into the economy. So now money that was earmarked for those things perhaps can be reapplied elsewhere inside
exactly.
the budget. Yeah.
Exactly. So that'll free up Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues' cash flow problems, and for I should imagine that what they're betting on is that with that kind of economic oxygen, they'll be able to kind of make it through into the next year, and by then they're hoping that oil prices will have recovered sufficiently to enable them to to get back to something like the kind of cash flow that they had in earlier years. And they're using that period to kind of readjust the Venezuelan economy so that they are not entirely dependent on oil revenue to be able to carry out their government program.
Right, to insulate it from another attack along those lines. You know, there's some really interesting things that are going on here in the larger context. Maybe we could jump into that for a minute and then come back and you know, to the region.
Yeah, but we should talk about the OEA and Luis Almagro.
Yeah, I want to do all of that. But right now, first of all, you have CELAC in Beijing, and some really contradictory moves from, maybe not contradictory, let's say comprehensive in any event, moves by China. You know, this assault against the region is also part of, just intrinsically, by attacking Brazil, an assault on the BRICS. You have sort of a coordinated assault on the BRICS by the West. The United States is engaged in developing a military alliance with India. You have all of the machinations that are going on against Zuma in South Africa. You also have China sending a naval task force to Cape Town last week as that develops there. You have China both cutting deals with the Argentinian government on, you know, as part of the CELAC negotiations, a sort of a sidebar there with Macri's government, making some moves that will economically support that government by supporting the Argentinian economy. They had kind words for Morales in Brazil, who's the new finance minister, saying that at CCTV, for example, called him a trusted and well-respected finance minister, or in any event, you know, financial person. And then you have this investment in Venezuela that shores up the government. I mean, China's like moving in both directions simultaneously, and on the ground in Latin America, you have, you know, the situation with wherever the right got a lever of power, they're using it not to govern, but to assault, you know, to consolidate power, basically, and to attack the left.
Well, to attack ordinary people.
Yeah, well, that's the left is essentially the political organ of the ordinary people. And so by, you know, by doing that, what they're doing is getting the impediment to their deeper exploitation of ordinary people out of the way by attacking the left.
Right. Yeah, and the thing to remember about China is that there's no necessary connection between the Chinese investment in Latin America and any putative support, Chinese support for progressive governments.
Right.
They might prefer, they might feel more comfortable dealing with, for example, Evo Morales or Rafael Correa, but they'll equally deal with a right-wing president in Peru, Juan Manuel Santos in Colombia, right, or Enrique Peña Nieto in Mexico, or Macri in Argentina, for example.
Right. Right.
So they, you know, there's no necessary connection between Chinese policy in Latin America and their feelings one way or another for the political flavor that may be in power in any given Latin American country. That's important to bear in mind.
Yeah.
But by the same token, and we've talked about this before, and the right-wing governments in Latin America, and they may be ideologically more sympathetic to the United States, the ideological agenda of the United States corporate elites, but they know that the future that is China and Asia. And so what they need to do is to maintain their traditional relationships with the United States. But the United States economy is not going to rebound. It hasn't recovered from the depression of 2008, 2009. And that's another subject. But essentially, the United States economy has not recovered and is not going to recover in the foreseeable future, because there's no change in sight to the economic policy agenda that prevails currently in the United States. And it's unlikely to change for the next, certainly over the next 5 years, it's unlikely to change. So what does that mean? That means that the United States markets for Latin American goods are going to stagnate if they don't collapse. Ditto in Europe. So what does that mean for Latin American governments? If their economies are going to grow, they have to project themselves increasingly into the Asian markets. And so those governments couldn't care less about the ideological flavor of the government in China, in the same way that the Chinese care very little about the ideological flavor of governments in Latin America. That dynamic means that there's a kind of divided loyalties in the foreign policies of the right-wing Latin American governments.
Well, I mean, you could even say that there is also at least apparently manifest the divided ideological loyalties inside China's elites as well. You have two tendencies there, right? You have the CP ideological tendency and the ideological pull of the billionaire class that exists there, or some members of it that don't necessarily see their future tied to the CP. And so, on the one hand, China playing a long game, you can see them saying, look, we're doing trade deals that are going to last 20 years. We want them to be fulfilled no matter who the government is. We're doing, as Chavez did, we're dealing, doing business with whatever. Your own political and social arrangements domestically are your own concern. Here's a contract. You want to do business. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, the United States, looking at the construct you just set up in terms of Latin America, looking to China as, and Asia as the future, the United States sees its future in regaining economic control of its, of the entire planet, really. And it has a very strong influence that is growing again among the political elites in Latin America. And as the United States impoverishes the economies in Latin America and sucks the blood out of them to sustain and try to grow its own economy, of course, that comes at the expense of what China is able to do, as well as of the people of Latin America.
Well, and there's a lot to talk about there.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that there's just a fundamental contradiction between the economic reality of Latin America and the U.S. attempt to kind of recover influence there. And they may recover, and they're certainly and it seems to me that if one analyzes what is the United States going to be able to do in realistic terms in order to consolidate its economic influence in Latin America and the Caribbean, and it's going to focus on intensifying its financial chokehold. And that's one of the things that China and the Russian Federation under Vladimir Putin and the ASEAN countries, and you can bet your life that they're the ASEAN countries, which we recently held a summit in Russia in Sochi, that was very successful by all accounts from the Russian point of view.
Right, last year.
The ASEAN countries, which comprise the really important economic powerhouses of Southeast Asia, like South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, those countries, and they're consolidating their relationships, and I'm sure much to the dismay of the United States, because it means that the economic nitty gritty, the productive power, in the world, is shifting from a more closely integrated relationship with the United States, which is what the Trans-Pacific partnership is all about, but it's shifting towards a closer relationship, a much more natural relationship too, with the Eurasian mass of China and the Russian Federation and the Eurasian Economic Union.
Right.
And so that is the global economic reality that Latin America faces. But what the United States is able to do is to leverage its still dominant position in the financial infrastructure, the international financial infrastructure, and that's what they're kind of, and what's that phrase that Matt Taibbi used? They're kind of trying to slap themselves like a giant blood-sucking squid.
You know, I mean, and you see the contradictions playing out. I described before the foreign minister, China's foreign minister, said about Macri. At the same time that Macri had people up in Washington signing for a new U.S. base in the south of Argentina and negotiating for one along the border with Brazil, where Paraguay already gave them one, by the way.
Yeah, and they've had a base in Paraguay for a long time. What is it, Tres Esquinas? I forget.
They signed a deal for that right after the coup, the constitutional coup, quote unquote, there.
Right. Yeah, that was something that Lugo was resisting, wasn't it? But why does the United States need military bases in South America?
Right.
What's that? You know, what's that got to do with anything?
Well, clearly,
it's completely in contradiction to their standard self-justifications. You know, we're defending freedom, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
and it's just the history of U.S. military intervention in Latin America is one inextricably related to mass repression and dictatorships, and so the installation of bases in Latin America, especially at a time when in Colombia, the government is moving closer and closer to sign a negotiated peace with the FARC guerrilla. And that it's just a complete anomaly for the United States to be installing military bases in anywhere in Latin America.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at it geostrategically, the insertion of the base into Paraguay between Brazil and Argentina, you know, predates by several years the, you know, affirmative offensive against both of those countries that we're seeing manifest now. And they've got the military base in position in case it's needed.
Yeah, and of course, one of the things that happened recently over the week was Evo Morales' visit to Cuba, in which he and the Bolivian government and the Cuban government cemented their relations even more closely than before. Both of those countries, of course, are members of the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas. But this at a time when Evo Morales and his government are likely to come into quite serious conflict with Chile over their territorial disputes. And not just now, it's not just the Bolivia's historic claim to access to the Pacific Ocean. It's also a claim to do with the extensive Silala wetlands that Chile has exploited for its own use for over a century now. And in completely ignoring Bolivia's legitimate claims on that very important natural resource. Last week we did, I don't think we discussed this last week, but I think it was the last week that there was a kind of mild increase in tension between Bolivia and Chile as a result of Bolivia's claims that the Chileans were increasing their military presence right next door to those disputed Silala wetlands. And so that, and of course, Bolivia has this case going in the International Court of Justice. So the installation of another U.S. military base and the consolidation of its existing base in Paraguay, so close to Bolivia, And it's certainly making the Bolivian government kind of much more sensitive to the military implications of what's going on in the region.
Right. Yeah, as well it should. I mean, you know, not for nothing, Paraguay also touches Bolivia. In fact, it touches Bolivia and Brazil and Argentina. So, yeah. You know, that base is located essentially in the center of the continent in terms of the distribution of nation states, and not too far from Uruguay either.
Yeah, and it's one of the interesting and worrying aspects of the usurpation by right wing governments of power in Argentina and Brazil, and you know the very real possibility of some kind of change of power in Venezuela, and when one just has to accept that that's a very real possibility over the next year, 18 months. Yeah. And the what is going to happen to institutions like Mercosur, where Venezuela is a member of Mercosur, Bolivia is now almost a full member of Mercosur. I think the Paraguayan legislature approved that last month. So you've got two countries that, for the moment at least, with very strong progressive governments in Mercosur, dealing with what are now two extremely right-wing governments in Brazil and Argentina.
Right.
So, and what's going to happen with Mercosur? How is that going to affect the southern cone in Latin America? That area's relationships with the European Union, because the European Union is pressing hard for Mercosur to engage in a TTP-style economic agreement between Mercosur as a bloc and the European Union as a bloc. What's going to happen about that now? And then what's going to happen inside the Union of South American Nations, UNASUR?
Right.
How is the new configuration of governmental power going to affect UNASUR and also CELAC,
right,
the community of Latin American and Caribbean states? And it's not at all clear how that's going to pan out, because in the case of CELAC, almost all governments, whatever their ideological complexion, view CELAC as a really important innovation that enables the whole region to negotiate as a bloc, for example, as you just said, with China. And so it's very unlikely the right-wing governments are going to set out to dismantle or sabotage CELAC, because it's so advantageous to them in terms of giving them greater negotiating power with China, with the European Union, for example. Let's see how that works out. But one thing I want to get back to is, in relation to CELAC in particular, is the role of the Organization of American States.
Yeah, I wanted to go there, because you see them, and it's kind of interesting, actually. The head of the OAS, if memory serves, is from Uruguay, and actually from the same party as the former president, and yet he's calling for the removal, if I remember the report last week, of President Maduro.
Yeah, and it's a guy called Luis Almagro. Now, that if anybody who reads Spanish, there's a very good article by Carlos Aznarez, the veteran radical journalist. I think he's Argentinian. He wrote a very perceptive article, a very persuasive article, in Telesur's Spanish section, analyzing the recent intervention by Luis Almagro and the defense of Almagro by Pepe Mujica, the former Uruguayan president. And so, and it was actually, I don't know if you saw the headline, but I mean, there was a headline in The Guardian that took some remarks by Pepe Mujica somewhat out of context, and splurged that as a headline as part of The Guardian's ongoing campaign against the Venezuelan government, as part of NATO's broader propaganda campaign against the the Venezuelan government.
Yeah.
And what Luis Almagro did was he went far beyond his legitimate mandate as the executive or the secretary general or whatever his title is of the Organization of American States. In intervening, actually, and I think he did, part of his intervention occurred in together with Alvaro Uribe, the former president of Colombia.
Right, that was.
And Almagro accompanied Alvaro Uribe's call for some kind of intervention in Venezuela, alleging that fundamental rights in Venezuela were being violated.
Yeah.
Which is such a complete misrepresentation of the actual situation in current in Venezuela at the moment.
Yeah, organizationally, that's an interesting position to take. I mean, if you look at UNASUR, which is the all-inclusive grouping in Latin America and the Caribbean, you know, the largest of those groups, they have been backing both Dilma Rousseff and Maduro and calling for non-intervention in both cases. And the members of UNASUR are the largest dominant bloc inside OAS. So I'm wondering where exactly he gets a mandate to do this in the first place.
Well, he has no mandate, and that's what's so extraordinary about his declarations.
Right.
He has no mandate to make those declarations. He in order to make those declarations, he needs to convene a meeting of the OAS and get a two-thirds majority authorizing him to make those kinds of declarations,
right.
or at least a majority. And then to invoke the so-called the Democratic Charter of the OAS, he needs a two-thirds majority. And he's nowhere near that. He's, you know, he hasn't got a hope in hell of getting anything like that majority. And presumably, that's the reason why he exceeded his mandate and has made these outrageous declarations in Latin American terms. Absolutely outrageous, calling for some kind of external intervention in the sovereign affairs of a member of the OAS that he has no business making. He has absolutely, he has no legitimacy at all, his remarks. And so then what's happened now is that Pepe Mujica, and there was a very severe pushback, very severe criticism of Luis Almagro from various leaders, for example, Rafael Correa and the Ecuadorian government, Evo Morales in Bolivia, and the Nicaraguan government too has rejected Luis Almagro's remarks. Other countries have kind of been less assertive and insistent. But the general feeling is that throughout the region that Luis Almagro far exceeded his mandate. So it was very surprising then that Pepe Mujica should come along and try and support Luis Almagro and criticize Maduro. And that was, but I've never had a good feeling about Pepe Mujica because he's kind of projected this image. He's always projected this image as kind of an endearing old buffer, you know. An endearing old cove, to use the British expression. Yeah. And he's actually a very astute and ruthless political operator. And his remarks, taken out of context in the Guardian report, were essentially an attempt to defend a position for the internal political purposes of Uruguayan politics. But anyway, and that's just a kind of little sideshow. But it does indicate that it's not only that the right wing are usurping governments in Latin America and in order to be able to implement an ideological agenda much to the liking of the United States government. What that process is doing is also opening up fissures between the progressive movements in Latin America. And next, I think it's next month in June, there's going to be a meeting of the Foro Sao Paulo. Now, the Foro Sao Paulo is a kind of extremely broad grouping of more or less left-wing political parties. But to give you an idea of how problematic the Foro Sao Paulo is, and the it's the PRD in Mexico that is the Mexican representative in the Foro Sao Paulo. And you're probably well aware that Don, that in Mexico, Manuel Obrador, Manuel Obrador, has been very successful in forming this new grouping called Moreno, which stands a very good chance of doing well in the Mexican elections, right, and perhaps displacing the traditional parties that have always disputed power in Mexico, the PRD and the PRI, and I've forgotten the right wing party, that have traditionally disputed power and in Mexico. And so the PRD have refused to allow Andrés Manuel López Obrador was invited to the Foro Sao Paulo, but the PRD refused to let him go because they argue that he's not formally a representative of a member organization of the Foro Sao Paulo. And that just shows you that it's so easy to kind of provoke division in that kind of broad alliance of progressive political movements. And that's also true at the level of governments in Latin America, because Tabaré Vázquez's government in Uruguay is not necessarily a natural ally of, for example, the Venezuelan United Socialist Party. And in good times, they'll string along together, but in bad times, they'll go their own way and kind of for their own internal they'll follow their own internal political interests and put those above the interests of regional integration.
Yeah, well, those contradictions are exactly the thing that the United States is expert at manipulating. If you look at Shia and Sunni killing each other in the Middle East and various national groupings amid the nation states and traversing the nation states in Africa, look at the Koreas and the attempts to turn Vietnam against China, and you know, all of this. This is what the U.S. does best, to turn people against each other, to find whatever points of contradiction there are and exacerbate them. And that is the classic divide and rule strategy that has lifted imperialism to the pinnacle of power globally.
I very much agree with that, Don, but I also think that this is a moment that in which it's really important for the progressive forces to be self-critical. And let's go back to Venezuela. And one of the things that I find terribly depressing about Venezuela is the way that the government tends to attack the people that have voted against it, who aren't necessarily natural supporters of the right wing. You know, people at grassroots, and I don't. Did you see the letter by the School of America's Watch, Lisa Sullivan?
No.
And Lisa Sullivan's lived in Venezuela for years, and she wrote a letter. I was very surprised by the letter. It was an open letter, published by the School of the America's Watch organization, in which she didn't criticize the government at all, but she did make it very clear that the effect on ordinary people at grassroots of the current economic difficulties is extremely severe. And she suggested, and this is somebody who's a diehard supporter of, if you like, of Chavez and the whole series of policies and the political movement that Chavez created. And she's saying that people in her communities and the communities that she knows are in fact going hungry. Now, for somebody like Lisa Sullivan to say that is it's a very, very significant thing to happen. And it does indicate that it may not be legitimate of the Venezuelan government and to engage in the kind of criticism that it has engaged in of ordinary people at grassroots who are just trying to survive. And we had this in Nicaragua. Let me tell you a story that you might find interesting.
Yeah, we're going to have to make it short, though, because we've got about 3 minutes left.
Okay, well, I'll make it quick. I think the situation in Venezuela is very similar to the situation in Nicaragua in 1990. And one of the things that happened after the electoral loss by the Sandinista government in 1990 was that they found themselves negotiating directly with the contra-revolutionary fighters. Now, one of those revolutionary fighters was a guy called Franklin Galeano. Israel Galeano. His alias was Comandante Franklin. Now, Franklin, he was subsequently killed, and he foresaw his death. And he had a meeting with a representative of the Nicaraguan government. I'm fortunate enough to count this guy among my friends, Orlando Nunez. And Orlando Nunez was assigned the role by the Nicaraguan government of negotiating directly with the Contra commanders. And when he had a meeting with Franklin Galeano, and Franklin Galeano said to him at the end of the meeting, "What's happened here in Nicaragua is that the oligarchy used you, the Sandinistas, to overthrow Somoza, and now they've used us, the Contra, to overthrow you, the Sandinistas." And so, and what was he saying? He was saying that the Contras fighters were just ordinary Nicaraguan people.
Right.
And that was the message that Orlando took away from that exchange.
Yep.
And that is one of the reasons why Nicaragua took that lesson to heart. And they reconciled they were reconciling with people who were murderers, rapists, who engaged in the terror campaign by the United States. But those Contra fighters, the great majority of them were just ordinary people who were exploited by the Nicaraguan oligarchy to overthrow the Sandinista government. Now, that is what is happening in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And so the Venezuelan government should think very hard before they start attacking ordinary people in Venezuela who, for reasons of their own natural self-interest, have supported the right wing, because they can't tolerate the kind of pressure, economic pressure, that they're having to put up with. And that was what happened in Nicaragua. And so one of the things that I find particularly depressing is that we don't learn from our mistakes. I know that the Venezuelans are in a process of looking hard at and self-critically at what they've been doing. And one of the things that they need to take on board is that historic experience of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. You cannot treat as your enemy the very people you say you represent.
Yeah, that is a tough lesson, and it's tough under the conditions that face everyone involved there. Tony, thank you. And hopefully things will turn around sometime soon for the people in that region and for all of us.
I hope so too, yeah. Let's see how things go.
Okay. Tony, thanks a lot. Pleasure as always.
Okay. You're very welcome, Don.
You've been listening to CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar, your host, and look forward to seeing you again next week.